Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's been 50 years since the landmark environmental law, the Clean Water Act, was passed in 1972. It was an ambitious piece of legislation, and it made a real difference in some of the most polluted rivers and waterways in the U.S. But a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project shows that half a century later, the promises of the Clean Water Act have only been half kept. Their research ranked Oregon as number two in the U.S. for the most miles of rivers and waterways that aren't safe for swimming and other kinds of recreation. I spoke with Eric Schaefer, one of the report's co-authors, to learn more about their findings. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. The Environmental Integrity Project has just released this report that shows that about half of the rivers, lakes, and reservoirs in the United States are still not safe for swimming, fishing, and recreation, which is, of course, contrary to what the Clean Water Act of 1972 would have provided. And that's definitely a big problem. To start out, for folks who may be unfamiliar, what did the Clean Water Act put into law back when it was first passed?
We were supposed to get fishable, swimmable water by 1983. And the law also set a goal of stopping the discharge of all pollutants into navigable waterways by 1985. We used to dream big back in those days. Obviously those were very ambitious goals. It turned out to be more ambitious than I think people realized at the time, but they are the targets we need to constantly be moving toward.
Right. Yeah. Thinking about that now is definitely remarkable, you know, in the context of how climate change and environmental stuff has been treated since then.
Oh yeah. And these passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. President Nixon actually vetoed it, but Congress overrode the veto by big margins. So quick advertisement for what the law did accomplish. If you're as old as I am, you can remember when the rivers smelled. And when I think somebody said the Cahoga River in Ohio oozed, it didn't really flow. It had so much crud in it, oil and gas and grease, that it caught fire. So we've gotten some pretty big improvements there. Those sort of dramatic river on fire scenarios, we have less of that. You can actually take a canoe down the Cahoga and the Potomac River. I'm in the D.C. area, which used to smell really bad if you rolled your windows down in the summer, is now a bass fishery. If we hadn't had the law passed in 1972, we'd be so much worse off than we are now, and we wouldn't have gotten those improvements. So I just want to recognize that.
One thing I saw was that Oregon ranks second among states with the most quote-unquote impaired river and stream miles. What are some of the driving factors there? What makes a river impaired?
So that does catch your eye. A river is impaired when a state evaluates the condition of the river or stream and finds out, based on a number of factors, that it's not safe for swimming or what we call contact recreation, wading, water sports, or it's not healthy enough to support aquatic life. And that means, of course, fish, but also all the critters that a healthy river needs to thrive. Those are the two main goals. There are a couple of others. Those are the two most important. So a quick point about Oregon, because it's actually first in terms of total number of impaired river and stream miles. And that caught my eye. You know, Oregon is a beautiful state where people come to fish and camp and, you know, explore the woods, and people live there for that reason. So it seemed very odd to me. And the reason is 90,000 miles of those impairments are caused by high temperatures. So the waters in the state are getting too warm to support aquatic life to be healthy. You have, you used to have anyway, a lot of cold water fisheries. You know, trout don't like tropical temperatures, obviously, and the temperatures are rising in the waterways. And there's been some back and forth between Oregon and the EPA about whether that should be sort of considered beyond the state's control, and there was some litigation over it. And the long and short of it is it's staying on the books as too warm to support aquatic life, because that is the truth. Climate change has an awful lot to do with that. I mean, it's I don't need to tell you, you're calling from Oregon, but it's gotten hot enough in your state to kill people. So it isn't surprising that you're having these warm water temperatures now in rivers and streams, and then that is putting the condition of those streams into a state where they're not going to be able, if it keeps going, to support a healthy ecosystem.
Right. Yeah. Certainly the temperatures that we've seen have been so much more extreme over the past few years. And that's, you know, we're standing outside the water and having problems with it. So, of course, fish can't be faring too much better. I want to zoom out and talk about the whole country. So, you know, thinking back to 1972 and now 50 years from then, what are the things that are driving the failure to fulfill on these promises? What's changed since the act was passed that means that half of our waterways are impaired in this way?
Nature doesn't stand still, and neither does the country or the industries that develop. We have now factory farming on a scale that just wasn't around in the early 70s or when the law was passed. And I'm talking about livestock operations that are grown under contract for about maybe 10 really large meat producers, you know, Tyson's for chickens and Cargill for beef and hogs and so on. And that involved putting a lot of animals in pretty small confined areas with not enough land to support all the manure that's generated. You can spread that manure and it makes great fertilizer, but if you have too much, it's going to wash into the waters. And so across the country now, we see agriculture, and particularly areas where you've got a heavy concentration of these big livestock operations, heavily polluted. And interestingly, in some of the prettiest areas where you have a lot of farming, you find more waters that are unsafe for swimming. That's primarily because the stuff getting into the water is carrying a lot of bacteria. You know, you get too much, and obviously it's unhealthy. You don't want to be in that water. So that's one set of problems. Another is the nitrogen and phosphorus comes out of that manure and will load up rivers and streams with algae and suck oxygen out of the water that fish need to survive. And that's a problem in many, many places. It's also caused by sewage overflows or sewage that's just not treated well enough. And we need to address that problem. But the lion's share from agricultural sources, and especially from those big concentrated livestock operations. So you were asking earlier about, or we were talking earlier about the impact that heat's had on water quality in Oregon. And you've got waters now that are too warm to support the fisheries that, you know, people have always enjoyed and gotten very fond of, and they're at risk right now. On the East Coast, we're getting some of the rain that you probably wish you had, but it's coming down harder and faster. You can get 2 or 3 inches in less than an hour now in heavy rain, and that's causing a lot of runoff, both from farm fields and from city streets, which will also carry pathogens and other pollutants into the water. And we're supposed to get more and more rain in, at least in the eastern states, as the climate changes. So we're going to need to face up to those challenges. Then, you know, the last thing I'll mention is there's still contaminants getting discovered that we couldn't even imagine in the 70s. PFAS and PFOA, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce their full chemical names, are two chemicals that were used to make Scotchgard and Teflon. They don't break down once they get into the environment. They're very tough chemicals. They're made to be tough. They're highly toxic, and they're kind of everywhere now. They're in groundwater. They're in drinking water supplies. They're found in rivers and streams. So that's one of the big new challenges that just wasn't on the map back in 1972.
Right. And another thing I saw in the report that I wanted to hear more about was the outdated technology standards that are in the Clean Water Act from the 70s for testing these kinds of things. And so how do those stack up against, you know, what the things that you're mentioning now, the stuff that, you know, we're currently up against?
That one's really frustrating. One of the best things that came out of the 1972 Act is that Congress said EPA needs to develop discharge limits on the amount of pollution you put in the water for major public and industrial wastewater treatment plants. So EPA laid standards out, and partly as a result of a lawsuit that forced them to, back in the 80s and through the middle part of the 90s. And then they mostly stopped. And what the law also said is, you know, once you have those in place, every 5 years, you need to take another look at them and tune them up, make them more stringent, because wastewater treatment methods keep improving. For example, meatpacking plants, which are all over the country, and you have some big ones in Oregon, they're operating under a standard now that's maybe 15 years old. So it's not one of the furthest behind, but just looking at the data from those plants, we were able to show that about a quarter of those facilities that can process beef, pork, chicken, had discharges that were of nitrogen in particular that were three or four times less than the rest of the industry. So they were able to, you know, produce the same amount of product, meat in this case, with about a quarter to a third of the pollution. When you see that, you know that, look, the treatment systems have improved. The way the law works is EPA is supposed to look at that, draw a circle around it, and say, okay, now it's time for everybody to do this. Because we've got, you know, these demonstrated improvements, we're going to raise the floor. We're going to raise the level of these sort of minimum standards. That's just not happening. About two-thirds of the industrial categories that are subject to these EPA standards are working under limits, federal limits, that haven't been reviewed in more than 30 years. And, you know, that's just wrong, and that needs to change.
The report covers all of these things, and of course it's important to understand the state of affairs and where we are vis-a-vis the Clean Water Act and waterways and improvements and things that still need to be done. What are some of your recommendations for lawmakers to tackle this problem?
We really need to get our arms around pollution from agricultural sources. It's very difficult politically. The Farm Bureau is a very loud interest group. They're constantly talking about family farms. In fact, as we were discussing earlier, for livestock operations anyway, you know, 90% of the meat that's produced come from contract farms that are really working for the big packing companies like Cargill and so on. Those big companies really need to be made responsible for the waste that their contract farms generate. The companies are the ones that are making the most money from that model. And that's something that, if we're going to accept that and live with it, I'm not saying that's a great idea, But if that model is going to stick around, the companies that make the most money off it really need to be made responsible for the pollution from those operators.
So when you were putting together this report and, you know, now releasing it to the public, have you found that there are common misconceptions that people have about contaminated waterways or the Clean Water Act?
Yeah, I don't have any real polling data on this, but if, because you're asking what do people, you know, imagine when they think about the Clean Water Act, I think one problem is people take it for granted and are, you know, I think two-thirds of the country is younger than 50. And so, you know, they weren't around when things were dramatically bad in a few places in the country that now have gotten better. So they, you know, maybe they don't have as much of a connection to this law that did so much. And I think there is a lack of awareness about the depth of some of these problems. What we find is kind of interesting is Oregon actually has more than 17,000 miles of rivers and streams that are impaired or too polluted to allow for safe swimming and what's called contact recreation. 17,000 miles, that's the second largest amount in the country. And those impairments, when you can't swim or enjoy the water, it's usually bacteria. Not always, but usually there are pathogens like E. coli or fecal coliform. Those can come from sewer systems, they can come from urban runoff, and they can come, and actually the bulk of them often comes, again, from agricultural sources. So one thing I don't think people are aware of is when you're in a very pretty, let's say a valley, and there are farms all around and there are livestock operations all around, but otherwise it's beautiful as long as the wind's, you know, blowing in the right direction and you don't have to smell the, you know, huge livestock impoundments. You're in a pretty area and you don't realize that the water isn't really safe to swim in because it's loaded with bacteria. Now you can figure that out if you look at the state maps and understand which parts of a river are too contaminated to jump in. But, you know, how many people are going to do that? If you live in a coastal area, there's federal law that says that the state has to warn people when there's too much bacteria in the ocean, in the saltwater, right? There's no comparable law for freshwater. I think one of the things that states could do and legislators can do is require postings that warn people that certain waters are chronically, you know, loaded with too much bacteria to make swimming safe. And periodically, like they do on beaches, warn people when there's a lot of bacteria in the water and you're at risk of getting sick if you get in. If you had more of that, I think you'd build awareness that we've got a problem here because, you know, we're coming to these places to enjoy the water. We can't get in. That might help to build the political will to get some cleanup done because you do need politics to work in your favor. It's never as simple as, you know, just reading the law and pushing some buttons. It's a lot of work to implement the law, and you need political will behind it.
So if folks are listening to this and are interested in seeing the report for themselves, how can they find out more info?
Environmentalintegrity.org. We'll have the report posted. We have tables that you can use to quickly look up where Oregon or wherever you live stands in terms of water qualities that have been studied and water qualities that are impaired.
That was Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project and co-author of the report, The Clean Water Act at 50, Promises Half-Kept at the Half-Century Mark. Their website with the full report is online at environmentalintegrity.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.